If you like hashtag am writing, and I know you do because you're here listening, you will love Writing Class Radio. Writing Class Radio airs true personal stories and gives you tips on how to write your own stories. We're also open to airing and discussing your personal essay. Everyone has a story. What's yours? Find Writing Class Radio wherever you find your podcasts.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay.
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone and try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is Hashtag Am Writing, the weekly podcast about writing all the things. Fiction, non-fiction, short things, long things, pitches, proposals. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 35 romance novels, and my new one is called Bombshells. You can find me anywhere ebooks are sold.
And I am KJ Delantonia, the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent, and the former editor and lead writer of The Motherlode at the New York Times. And I'm currently working on another novel, and the best place to find me is Instagram, where I am at KJDA, although of course I have the obligatory writer website. It's a good one, too. And we have a guest today. We are super, super delighted to welcome our guest, cookbook author Reem Cassis. And let me tell you a little bit about her. She is a wildly successful food writer who is fresh off an appearance on Fresh Air and who never, quote, should have written a cookbook at all. Here's her bio in her own words. She says, I grew up a Palestinian in Israel. I went to an American missionary school, and by the grace of whatever gods were looking down on me in sheer grit, I came to UPenn for undergrad, where I snuggled in a struggle. I don't think she snuggled. Sorry. She might have, but that's a different podcast.
That's a different conversation.
Yeah, totally different podcast. Let's go on with this one. Where I struggled initially, but kept going until I graduated in the top of my class and went straight on to do my MBA at Wharton. From there, McKinsey, the London School of Economics, the World Economic Forum, and, by any measure, a fast-track, prestigious career. But I felt disillusioned when I realized I was following the herd and living someone else's version of success, not mine. So I turned my back on the whole thing and decided to write a cookbook. We love this bio so much because we both have very similar stories, and we're super excited to talk to you, so welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to talk to you guys, too.
This is going to be fun. Reem's first cookbook was The Palestinian Table, and the second, which is out now, is The Arabesque Table. They are both about the foods of her childhood and the foods that she grew up on, but this is not the dream of your childhood, and that's where I wanted to start. Can we talk about that move from that corporate ladder into cookbook writing? I think the first place to start is that decision to step down.
So
what was that like?
It's interesting because when you look at where someone ends up and where they started out, it seems like it was this straight line or this trajectory that goes upward. But in reality, KJ, the line is a lot more like a zigzag with ups and downs. And the decision to leave was not a super clear-cut romantic thing where it's like, oh, I'm going to turn my back on everything and I'm going to become the successful author. It was laced with a lot of doubt and insecurity. And it started out when my first daughter was born. And I was living in London, where you get a full year of maternity leave, which was amazing. And I started thinking, you know, how is my daughter going to grow up? She's so far away from her roots, from her culture, from the very things that have grounded me throughout my life. And I wanted to, in a way, safeguard that for her. And that's where the idea of compiling my family's recipes and stories came into being. And it was only once I combined them together and started working on it that I thought, hey, why don't I turn this into a cookbook? I mean, it's indeed my story and my family's recipes, but at the same time, together as a whole, they could be the story of any Palestinian family. And you guys are probably aware, those aren't the first stories we think of when we think Palestinian, right? You know, you think politics and conflict and wars, and I wanted to show a human face to my people and my side of the world. And that's where the idea of the book came in. And having come from a business background with no experience in publishing, no contacts, no idea what to do, I literally Googled, how do you write a cookbook? And I wrote a proposal. I sent it to, you know, we can get into that later if you want in detail, but
we're going to.
Okay. So once the book came out and it took on a life of its own, I slowly transitioned to that and decided not to go back full time to work, because it was, and that decision was the hard one, because you're giving up something that you've worked so hard to do, to step into a field that you always said, I don't want to be in. And then there's all the ensuing things that are related to that, right? You know, you're moving from business consulting to food writing, you know, the income is drastically different as well. And you're doing it because it's a labor of love. You're not doing it for the accolades or the, you know, the fame. None of that is guaranteed when you're starting out. But the book did well, and I thought it would be my last book and I would eventually go back. But I guess this little bug got in my head and the second book was born. And we can also get into detail about why that one came about.
Did you go straight from I'm compiling these and I'm going to make a book proposal? Or was there a stop in the arena of food writing first? Like, did you pitch pieces to magazines or did you go straight to a cookbook proposal?
Oh, it was straight to a cookbook proposal. It was literally, wow. You know, like I said, I Googled, how do you write a cookbook? And it said, you need to write a proposal and then you need to find an agent. And I ended up writing a 100-page proposal for what was ultimately a 250-page book, which in and of itself is kind of insane, but that's where I guess the business background kind of helped out. And I remember I was sending it to these literary consultants, people that basically you pay them a bit of money, they'll look at your stuff and tell you, is it even good enough to be sent to agents? And I think I sent it out to 3 or 4 and they all said, you're nobody. We don't know who you are. You have no platform. You've never written about these things. Why would we even take you on? Sorry. And then one woman said, I think what you have is a masterpiece. I don't think anyone is going to publish it because you're nobody, but I'll take you on and help you, you know, get the proposal to where it needs to be. And I think for her, there was also this whole idea of, and then you need to spend 6 months developing a platform and maybe I can help you with that. Of course, I never did that. I gave birth to my second daughter by that point, and I shoved my proposal in a drawer and thought, okay, great. They're telling me it's great, but no one's going to publish it. I'm just going to forget about it. And it's funny because all it took was one evening. One of my very best friends had come over to congratulate me because my daughter was born, and I mentioned this idea to her, which up until that point, I had not shared with anyone other than my mom and my husband, because I also felt a little embarrassed about it. Like, why am I even dabbling in food? It's not what I worked for. And she goes, you'd be crazy if you don't do something with this. And that was when I thought, you know what? I have nothing to lose. I'm going to pitch it to agent. What's the worst that can happen? They're going to say, no, I anyway don't have an agent now. So I started pitching it. And simultaneously, I was like, yeah, I'm not going to get an agent. So why don't I find some random publisher who's willing to publish books without for people who don't have agents? And again, I went to my trusted source of information. I was like, hey, Google, what are some independent publishers? And Fiverr came up. I had no idea who they were. I called them and I was like, hey, do you guys take unsolicited manuscripts? And they go, yeah, sure. Here's our email. You can send us yours. So I did. And then I get a call back from them. And I show up with a 3-month-old who's nursing, wearing leggings and a sweater. And then I finish the meeting with them and I go home and my husband goes, you know, they published the cookbooks for Noma and El Bulli and all these top 50 restaurants. And you literally showed up like this to the meeting. And in hindsight, I'm like, how did I even do that? I mean, I tend to be someone who's very thorough in their research, but I just, things were happening fast at that time and with 2 young kids and I just showed up and I ended up signing with an agent, but they got back to me with an offer. And by that point, you know, I had learned more about them, who they were, and I ended up publishing the book with them. But it went, yeah, straight from zero to cookbook.
Serena went straight from zero to cookbook too. Before her, am I giving things away? Before
I'm curious now.
Her illustrious romance career.
Yeah, we don't talk about my before publishing life on this podcast, but I essentially did the same thing. A friend and I wrote a proposal, sold it to Random House. It was like the easiest publishing sale of my life. Because sometimes the hook is strong enough. Like if you don't have a blog with 30,000 followers, but you have a cookbook that isn't out there yet, then sometimes that is really enough, that you have this special lens on what's happening in that little corner of the culinary world, and that works. So, but what that means is there's some things about the publishing contract that you are finding out, like, right away, you know, just in the moment of it. And I had come from a derivatives trading background to my first publishing contract. So, you know, and we could go read a book about who gets to publish nonfiction right now, and it would say that neither of our books is publishable. And it doesn't matter. You know, 15 years later, my cookbook is still in print, in hardcover. So, but I'm curious about one thing. How was the art handled for your book? Because that was the most shocking thing to me about my cookbook contract, is what about the photography?
So the thing with Fiden, and the main reason I went back to them for the second book, is they handle everything from start to finish, and you as an author only have to write the book. So the photography, the first time around, they ended up picking the photographer. They knew that I was going to go travel back home and cook the rest home, as in Jerusalem, and that's where I was going to be cooking the dishes. And they found someone who was local. And initially I was surprised because I was writing a Palestinian cookbook, and yet they'd gone and hired an Israeli photographer. And as it turned out, it was the best team I could have asked for. You know, we clicked very well. The end product was amazing. And so this time around, even though the book did not need to be photographed there, I insisted on working with him again, and we did the shoot at my parents' house all over again, but they managed and handled all of it. How was your book? Did you have to find a photographer and do everything yourself?
Well, I happened to be co-writing it with my best friend, who is a photographic consultant. So she had it was easy. She did it all. But what I was surprised is that in cookery and crafting and other kinds of publishing like this, that it often comes out of the advance. So on our show, when we talk about how book contracts work, and our listenership is, you know, really clued into that, it's you get an advance and that money is yours, you know, and you never have to pay it back. But in culinary and some other parts, you have to also pay for the photography. And that's an open question if you have never produced a cookbook before. And the specs were really, like, there was not even a spec in our contract for digital photography.
Oh, wow.
And so we had to ask permission to shoot the book digitally with, you know, with this great New York photographer. It was all fine, but that's like a thing that you could learn trial by fire if you, right. It's like the money, it's X, but it's X minus the cost.
Minus all the other things.
Yeah, 50 photographs, and that's pricey.
It is, and I know a lot of people in the cookbook publishing world who've had it that way, and it varies from publisher to publisher, even from imprint to imprint within the same publisher. Generally, at least this is, and again, you know, my sample size is very small. It's not significant by any means, but most of the people that I've asked about this have said their advances, when they're going to have to find the photographer and do like the copy editing or the indexing or all of it themselves, they tend to be a bit higher. My advance was not it was not a high advance by any stretch of the imagination. But with that said, I didn't have to cover the cost for anything else. They also do their own PR in-house, which for people is, again, an important point. Like, once your book is out in the world, who's responsible for the promotion? And that varies as well by publisher. Some of them have in-house PR. Some of them will hire someone outside. Some will say, hey, good luck, go figure it out yourself. Right. So those are things, I guess, that are very important to figure out from the get-go. And that's where having an agent is useful. I did the second book without an agent, and we can also get into that if relevant.
Yeah, and a lot of times anyone with their first publishing contract is afraid to ask questions and is afraid to push back on any of these things. And that's, you know, that's tricky.
Yeah, you're afraid. You're like, they're agreeing to publish my book. What if they decline to do it now if I ask more questions? But the answer is always no if you don't ask, so you might as well.
So as you look back on that journey, what are some things that you can think of that you did to help you sort of break down the bias against people who don't, as Serena said, have a blog with 30,000 followers or a famous restaurant or anything like that? It sounds like your proposal writing process was pretty in-depth.
I think that was probably the single most thing that allowed me to break through that barrier of not having a platform, because agents, they probably get God knows how many emails a day with manuscripts. Even as an author who's published a book, you will often, I'm sure you've seen this, get messages from people saying, hey, I want to publish a book. What should I do? But when you actually do a lot of the legwork yourself and you go really in depth, they realize that taking a risk on you might pay off. Like my agent said to me, he said, I told my assistant, if she can write this kind of email and this kind of proposal, she can probably write a book. And so then it just becomes a matter of it takes is one agent or one publisher to say yes, right? So you need to find that agent or publisher who believes in what you're doing. And the problem now is the market is so crowded. It is so saturated with so many people, bloggers, influencers, and you no longer can tell the difference between what's good and what's bad. And I guess that's where the gatekeepers, the agents come in. And you need to impress them. And the best way to do that is to do your homework. And by that, I mean really get down to the nitty-gritty details of what you're doing. It's probably different for fiction. You actually have to write the whole book. But for nonfiction, you have to have a proposal that's very detailed.
Well, we talk a lot on this podcast about how few people take a professional approach to getting an agent or submitting a book. People, finish something, the first draft, they think they're done, and they immediately send it out there. Or they send the same email to 25, 50 different agents. Or, you know, there are a lot of, or they don't get the names right. They don't look at the website to see what people want. And those are all, you know, those are the marks of someone that agents and publishers are willing to and want to work with.
Right. I mean, what I did, I used to go to bookstores. Again, I had a baby at the time, so it was great. You know, she would sift through the kids' books and I would sift through cookbooks and I would write down the names of every agent in every cookbook that I liked. And then I would go home and I'd research them and I'd figure out, okay, so what else did they write and what are they known for? And then I would send out very targeted emails. So it is a lot of legwork and it might not pay off. So some people think, oh, well, if it doesn't pay off, then why should I be doing it? If you don't have the desire to be doing that regardless of what happens in the end, then maybe it's not the right profession for you.
Right. If you're not fascinated by those acknowledgments and the list of agents, as I think we all are.
I have a friend when I lived in New York who thought she wanted to be an actor. And she really enjoyed all of her experiences on stage. But then she sort of trailed another actor for a week and saw a lot of auditioning and thought, "Ugh, I'm just not going to, I hate auditioning." And that person said to her, "Look, if you want to be a professional actor, you have to like auditioning because we do this a lot." And it's kind of that same idea. Like if you don't want to do the pitch and you don't want to do the homework, well, it's going to be really hard to have a career in publishing.
Yes. I mean, when it comes to like being a freelancer, I love the pitching process. I get really excited. I love putting something out there. I loved the getting an agent. I loved the finding an editor. I obviously had success, but that's not why I loved it. And it hasn't by any means all been a story of success. Like you said, my first book was actually way back in 2006. I never even mentioned it on the podcast, not because there's anything wrong with it, but just because it's old. And I was a co-written book called Reading with Babies, Toddlers, and Twos. And it was very, I bring it up because it was kind of similar. I wrote it with a friend. Neither of us had a platform. She had a little platform because she had a not-for-profit that was about young reading education. And it was a guide to how to read with a baby or a toddler, thus the title. And, and we got a lot of no's and ultimately went with source books and, a very, very tiny contract. But it was, it was great. It opens doors. It starts things up. It was good. You mentioned in your email to us that you were able to get Anthony Bourdain to endorse that first mm-hmm. cookbook. So let's talk about being, sort of like, here I am not a member of your club or a member of any club related to this cookbook producing thing. How can I get people on board with letting me in?
I think this goes back to the same thing I told you. All it takes is finding that one person, that one gatekeeper that can get you in. And with Anthony Bourdain, it was I read up a lot on him, on who to reach out to, and it was his assistant. You know, everyone said, you need to get to him, you need to get through his assistant. And so her name was Lori Wolliver, and I found an email and I reached out to her, and it ended up, I was reaching out to some high school teacher in the middle of some random state, I don't even remember which one, and she was the wrong person. And she wrote back and she's like, this is so nice, you're so sweet, but like, I'm not that person, you know? So the
I would totally help you, honey.
If I could, I would, but I'm not the right
person. She probably
brought
the cookbook.
Oh my God, who? Maybe, at least, that's true. I never thought of that. That's a good point. And anyway, eventually I found her on Facebook. I reached out to her. And similar to before, it was an email that showed I'd done my homework. You know, I explained to her why I was reaching out and what my background was. At the same time, I think people sometimes underestimate just how far being nice and being kind can get you. Like, don't email people with this entitled sense of, you should do this for me because X. It's, hey, I'm asking you for this favor. I would be extremely grateful. I completely understand if not. And I think she might have liked the story I told her. I have no idea why, but she agreed to take it to him. And he wrote back with the blurb, which was fascinating. But also I continued. And to this day, you know, I'm in touch with her. I sent her a copy of this book when it came out. And a lot of what happens in our lives, I think, is a function of the relationships we have. And there's nothing like, my biggest pet peeve is people who are opportunistic. Like, I'm nice to you because I might be able to get something from you. And then I'm going to forget about you until the next time I need something. And people can pick up on that. You can tell who's being nice because, oh, I need something, and then I won't talk to you for 2 years at a time, versus someone who genuinely cares and appreciates something that you've done for them. And so it takes up a lot of time and effort, but to me, it's time and effort well spent on nurturing relationships and genuinely caring about the people you interact with.
So when the book came out, I would imagine that you wanted to place pieces in food publications and in newspapers that would lead people to the book, because that's what publishers always want us to do. And I would love to hear how you got started in, you know, sort of turned yourself, you have to turn yourself into a food writer at that point, which is different than a cookbook writer. What was that experience like?
So actually, it's very interesting because my experience varied considerably between the first book and the second book. With the first book, I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea you were even supposed to do that. So I was emailing the PR person at my publisher saying, you know, who's going to pitch this to this magazine? And they are like, yeah, we'll pitch these ideas, we'll pitch whatever. But I didn't actually reach out to anyone to pitch food articles back then because I didn't even know you were supposed to do that. The book got some publicity through PR from the publishers themselves. It was, you know, it was nominated for some awards, which generated more publicity. But this time around, I knew that that was what you were supposed to do. And I had been leading up to the book, there's about a 4-year gap between the first book and the second book. I had pitched articles to different places and managed to place a few of them. But again, like you said, most of the time, it's not even a no. Most of the time, it's radio silence. People just don't respond. And I think that's the most frustrating thing of all. Is it bad? If it's bad, okay, I'll improve it. But if no one even responds, it's like, I'm sending this into the void.
And we just, our listeners to know that happens to, I mean, that happens to me. You know, I've written for the New York Times for how many years? I could easily pitch something tomorrow and get radio silence from them. Absolutely. Not if it's somebody that's a friend, but if it's somebody new, absolutely. So yeah, even after a successful award-winning cookbook, you still get like crickets.
Even like editors you've worked with and you've published something for that's done incredibly well, they're just probably so overwhelmed that if you send something and it doesn't fit right then with that specific, you know, topic or time, they'll just forget to get back to you. And who of us hasn't forgotten to respond to emails at one point or other?
What did you learn about the difference between what you needed to pitch to be successful with a magazine or a newspaper and the cookbook pitch, which is different?
I think the magazine or the newspaper pitches, those have to be very timely. So it's what's going on right now in the food world or what's going on in whatever genre that you're in. And how can I pitch it to someone at a time that they're actually going to find it appealing? With the cookbook, it's a much longer process and it's a much more involved process, right? Like a pitch for an article is maybe a paragraph, a little bit more. And for a book, you're actually spending a lot of time just figuring out what the book is about. And you were talking about enjoying the pitching process. I find the pitching process and the proposal writing process to be the places where you really get to think about what your book and your piece is about. And then you start and it's very technical, for lack of a better word. You're like, okay, so how do I, you know, break it up and what do I talk about now? But the actual intellectual part of it happens when you're pitching and when you're writing the proposal. So it's a time to be cherished in a way.
They are such different skills. And when KJ says, oh, I love pitching pieces, I think, you know, there's nothing about that process that's interesting to me. I feel late on everything. And I realized
as she
talks about that, I'm like, you know, I'm a marathoner. I'm not a sprinter.
Yeah. I hate the lack of responses. That's the worst part of the pitching process.
I hate that too. I like it when I have a good idea that I'm excited about and I'm determined to find a place for it. I find that excited. Or, you know, I like the process of figuring out which agents might be interested in my book proposal. Mm. I love, you know, reading the acknowledgments and seeing where the overlaps are and you know, which people, the whole industry fascinates me, not just like the thing that I want to write about. And I think that's true of most people who are successful in it. So let's talk about the book itself, because we haven't talked about that at all. And I think people would like to hear, you know, what kind of cookbook are we talking about here? So we know it is Palestinian food for the first one. And in this one, you called it the Arabesque Table. Talk to me about what's in there.
So this one here is very different from the first in that it takes a step back. It's a much wider lens. The first one is like a personal narrative. You see Palestinian cooking through the history of my family. Done. This one, it came about as a result of two things. On the one hand, I looked at how we were eating here abroad and how Arabs in general were eating in this cross or multicultural way. You know, your fridge has, it can have halloumi cheese and it can have za'atar, but it also probably has like Korean gochujang and Japanese soy sauce. And I wanted to cover this new cross-cultural table. But as I started getting into the book, I realized, well, you need to know the history for that proverbial table to have any legs to stand on. And I started digging into the history of food. And I realized it was so fascinating. I mean, so much of what we eat today and think of as authentic or traditional to certain countries didn't even exist just 200 years ago. And so the book is a snapshot of what a modern Arab table looks like, but also tracing the history back and showing places where this culture has intersected with others. And I think it has a wider appeal than the first one just because it's broader. It's easier in many cases. It's more modern for, you know, the home cook today doesn't have 5 hours to spend rolling grape leaves, right? So this one's definitely, you know, has a broader and bigger appeal than the first one, I would say.
And it has beautiful, I actually won't buy a cookbook without color pictures of what the food is supposed to look like, even though it never ends up quite looking like that. Because I don't know, that's what inspires me to cook, personally.
Right. Mm. I mean, the pictures are a big part of it. And I noticed from the, you're saying it doesn't come out the same. I mean, you should see what it takes to photograph one of these pictures, right? So we'll bring the dish out. And within 5 minutes, the photographer is like, add more oil. It's drying up. It's not as shiny as it needs to be. Or add this or add that or bring a tweezer and move this here and move that there. So don't be surprised that your food doesn't look exactly the same. I mean, these pictures are...
There are gradations of food styling too. There are the people who won't add a weird ingredient to make it look shiny if that ingredient isn't already in the thing. Right. But then a lot of food stylists will put corn syrup in the tomato sauce just to give it like a lasting sheen. And you definitely don't want to eat that when they're done. Or to photograph soups, the trick of like putting the mashed potatoes on the bottom of the bowl and then they put a little bit of soup and then the little chunks like stick up above the to give it texture because a bowl of
or
soup
an inverted
without,
bowl or something
but a bowl of soup with no help is just like a flat know little pond with nothing.
True. Yeah, I mean, the photographer I worked with, he was very particular. We didn't have a food stylist or a prop stylist or anything. It was just me, him, and my mom. And he's very particular. He only uses natural light. So there's no flash. There's no additional lighting. And we don't add anything to the food that's not in it. So if it got dry, you would have to use like the oil from the pan itself to brush it. Or but we stuck pretty true to what the recipes mm-hmm. were supposed to be like. But still, you know, it's plated nicely and you have the lighting that's coming in. And of course, I mean, even when I make it, it doesn't look exactly the way it does in the book.
The photography process, it drove me straight up a tree, honestly. You know, it was like, take the first shot and then spend 40 minutes discussing whether there should be a fork in the shot or a glass, right? Or whatever. I was like, that's gorgeous. Let's move on.
I'm like you. I'm like, it's good enough. And he was a perfectionist and was like, no, it's good, but it's not perfect. And I would just, oh my God, you really have to. My biggest fear was always having to repeat a dish. Because, you know, they're involved. Uh-huh. And when you're cooking 10 dishes a day, because we had to squeeze the whole shoot into 2 weeks.
Yeah, right.
So if you're doing 8 to 10 a day, the last thing you want is to have to add something else on to another day because you need to repeat it. So I feel you.
So you said when you were working on your topic that you were surprised that the history of some of the foods you were writing about was not quite as long and meant something different to you about how historical they were or weren't. And did that change your perspective of what is an ethnic food?
Yes. So, I mean, you could argue that my first book is a Palestinian cookbook, i.e. a national cuisine. But then what I realized researching this is the very idea of national cuisine is a recent construct. It came about after the French Revolution, where the cuisine of the Versailles Palace was nationalized. And whereas before it was you ate based on your level in society, whether you were a noble, a royal, a peasant, now everyone had access to the same foods. And it became a way around which to galvanize this idea of nationalism. You see it in Italy. You see it, I mean, in Italy, people will fight over what's better, Neapolitan or Roman cuisine, but to the world, it's all Italian. And you realize that food is very regional, and those regional differences are very marked throughout history. But what's even more fascinating is, since we're talking about Italy, think of tomatoes. They didn't come to Italy until the 19th or the late 18th century. Yet you ask anyone, hey, what's Italian food? And they'll say pizza, pasta, lasagna, or they'll name any of a number of dishes that are very heavily tomato-based. And yet tomatoes only came after the Columbian exchange. Same with cocoa beans into Switzerland and Belgium. Same with chilies into India and Thailand, or potatoes into Ireland. So all these places that we associate with certain dishes and certain ingredients looked so different 200 years ago. And I think that just frames all these arguments around ownership and appropriation and national cuisine in a very different light for me, which was eye-opening in a way.
I love what you said in the introduction of the book about how, you know, every culture, there are certain things that sort of turn out to be in common. Like every culture wraps some form of bread around some form of meat. Something that I have consistently noticed as a cook who cooks from a lot of cultures is that every culture has ways of stretching small amounts of meat into a larger, much larger dish. Like that's, you know, because that's if that's what everyone would have needed to do. So to be able to go back and look at it in this case as an entire region of people, you know, groups that have a lot of conflicts, but also have a lot in common, I think is really, it's a fascinating part of the cookbook.
Yeah, I mean, for me too, it was, you look at right now when my daughters, they're picky eaters. So they like tacos. So I say, okay, we're going to have tacos tonight. And what are we really eating? We're eating shawarma, but it's wrapped in tortilla bread. So they'll buy it, they'll eat it. But you see, it's not surprising given, you know, human beings are very similar regardless of where they are. So if you throw someone in China and you throw someone in, you know, in Lebanon and you give them similar ingredients, it's not that surprising that they would come up with a similar end product. And the differences that you see arising end up being a function of the geography and landscape, you know, what ingredients you have access to, religion in some cases, or socioeconomic status. Like back home, people think of our food as very heavily rice-based, but we didn't start eating rice as a staple until this last, you know, the 20th century.
Even the religious distinctions are typically rooted in some form of geography. Yeah. You know, it's probably about health and, you know, what was really good and what wasn't to eat more than it is about something that is, you know, faith-based when you look at them more closely. Right. So it is fascinating. I just want to whet everyone's appetite a little bit with a couple of things in here that are leaping out at me. I love the idea of za'atar schnitzel. I don't know if I'm saying za'atar right.
No, well, very good.
Okay, good. I have za'atar. I mean, you were saying, you know, you have these different meat ingredients. I have za'atar in my spice drawer.
Right.
I can whip
which
this one
would have
up.
Been unheard of a few decades ago, right?
Absolutely. I could never have found it. And it wasn't like, you know, I found it. They had it at the grocery store. It wasn't a big deal. I'm looking, because they look delicious, at sambusak with spiced lamb and pine nuts, which, to make them sound more familiar, I might call empanadas.
So
that's what they look like, right?
Exactly. And this is exactly what you were pointing about before. You know, all cultures wrap meat in a bread. All cultures have a version of this. Whether you go to samosas in India, sambusak in the Arab world, empanadas in South America, everybody stuffs something into some dough and bakes it or fries it. So.
Yes. And Reem was nice enough to share a recipe with us, which is going to be in our show notes. But I'm going to ask you to pronounce the proper, I would call it date and nut balls, but it has a better name.
Sure. Bsise?
Bsise?
Close. Yeah, very good.
Try my best. They sound amazing, and they're a snack to fuel your writing and a gift from Reem to us. So let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk about what we've been reading. Spring is coming, slowly, here in New England, and we're excited about the whole idea of change and new beginnings and birds and grass and stuff like that. What does that have to do with hashtag AmWriting? Well, maybe it's time for a new beginning for you as a book coach. Just imagine enrolling in the classes, meeting a cohort, learning all the ways coaches are editorial and emotional support for writers, and then starting to line up your first clients. Students working with Author Accelerator's book coaching program say they often begin to book authors before they're even done with the course, and they end up being booked ahead months in advance. Sound like fun? I absolutely agree. Go to bookcoaches.com to learn more. All right. Reem, read anything really good lately? Or if you want to throw a cookbook that you love out there at us, we'd be happy to hear that too.
God, I read cookbooks the way you would read novels, basically.
I
have
do
them
too.
Next to my bed. And yeah, the ones that are written well are very, very good. So one of the recent cookbooks I've been reading is called Beyond the North Wind. It's a Russian cookbook. And it's just fascinating because it puts history along with, you know, recipes. And it gives you an entire sense of place and time, not just recipes. But I also read, like, across the gamut. You know, I read a lot of fiction when I have time. And I recently picked up a book called The Mountain Sings, which is, you know, it's written by a Vietnamese author. And I came across it, again, reading a food article of all places. And the other one that I'm reading right now is called Your Turn, How to Be an Adult. So I read her, it's by Julie Lithcott-Hames. I read her first book about how to raise an adult. And to me, it was the best book ever because I felt less guilty about not being super helpful to my kids. So anytime they come in, they ask for something, like, God, just go away. Just give me 5 minutes. And I always felt so guilty. And then I read her first book and it was saying, basically, let your kids fend for themselves to an extent. I mean, I'm overly simplifying it. So her new one just came out and I haven't started it yet, but I got the book and I want to dig into it because maybe I'll feel less guilty just about the way I am as an adult in general.
So that made me think, with the talking about putting cookbooks on your bedside, made me think of the last one that I had by my bedside, which was Ruth Reichl's My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Saved Me. And it is as much about her, you know, the end of the magazine,
right,
as it is about any form of recipe. I don't know that I ever cooked anything out of it. You know, maybe I did, maybe I didn't, but it was such a joy.
Yeah, which is totally fine. I think a lot of these cookbooks are as much memoir as they are cookbooks. And I say that, you know, because for a lot of people, we look at cookbooks with this lowbrow perception, like, oh, what is it? It's just food. It's just recipes. But at the same time, if you think about it, there's a couple of reasons for this. But a lot of these cookbooks can also be, with time, historical tomes, you know, things that tell you what life was like at a certain period in time. I think one of the reasons cookbooks have a bad reputation sometimes is they're not as harshly or critically vetted as other genres of writing. So if you're doing nonfiction or academic or even fiction writing, you know, a lot goes into making sure that the content is true. With writing, it's just, with cookbooks, it has traditionally been just about making sure the recipe works, if even.
Well, that brings me to a totally crazy question that we should have asked earlier, and I didn't. Did anybody check to make sure you could cook?
So it's so funny. No, nobody checked that I could cook. But what the publisher said was they see so many cookbooks and so many recipes that they're at a point where just by reading a recipe, they can tell if it works or not, which I found fascinating. But once you have written the book, they do send it to recipe testing, professional testing. And that's, Serena, I don't know what your experience was like, but with my first book, they sent it to a professional recipe tester and they obviously covered all the costs for that. I didn't have to do anything. This time around, they didn't send it to a recipe tester, which I'm like, yeah, that's kind of risky. But I guess the first one, they realized it worked. So this one, this time around, they're like, you just test it, make sure it works. And that was
it. It's funny you say that because in my contract, it said that that had to happen and we got it taken out. We're like, I'm not paying for that. Because it's a hard thing to find. Like if they were going to make it my problem, you know, I don't know if I could have found that in an efficient way. But the cool thing about cookbook editing is that even after your editor with those mountains of experience is done, the copy editor also is a specialist. So the copy editor will say, you know, actually this would be 2 cups of shredded cheese.
Right.
There's a lot of experience looking at those recipes and it would be hard to have one that just totally bombed.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it goes through multiple layers of editing. It's not just for content, right. But again, like you're saying, everything from volume and measurements to.
And if we're all doing cookbooks today, then the one that I've been reading this week is the Food 52 Genius Recipes, 100 recipes that will change the way you cook. And it just speaks to my little analytical brain that, you know, they're like, oh, don't cook the eggs like this. Do it this other way. And, you know. Yeah. I don't know. There's something like a little twist of science and efficiency that I enjoy.
I love those. I love any book that makes life easier and gives you a new way of doing something that you've been doing basically wrong all along.
Yeah, I've been cooking for a year now out of a random magazine from Cooks Illustrated called Chinese Recipes. It's not even a cookbook. It's just one of their special interest publication, but my family happens to really love any form of Asian food. And this so cookbook has, I mean, you know, it's got everything. It's got all kinds. And of course, now we live in a really rural place. So there's a lot of stuff we can't get. So if we want to eat mushu, I better be cooking mushu. And that's what's been happening. So anyway, yeah.
Oh, I need to get the name of that book from you. Because my daughter always says, my favorite food is Asian food. She's willing to live off of sushi.
Me too.
So, so I need to get the name of that book.
Well, I'm going to be pulling it out to put it in the show notes, so I'll send it to you as soon as I find it. It's a little hard to find a magazine link, but I will find it. I know it's out there. I've sent it to other people. So this was great. We want to just say thank you so, so much for coming and telling us about the process.
Thank you, guys. This was one of the funnest conversations I've had.
Yay! Wait, more fun than fresh air.
Fresh air, I was very nervous. I don't know if you could tell how nervous I was. I could barely breathe, but yeah, it was. That was a good one too.
Yeah. All right. Reem, where should people find you if they want to follow you online?
Instagram is the easiest, reem.cassis, and then there they can link to my website or anywhere else if they want.
Great. All right. Serena, you want to take us out?
Of course. Well, listeners, until next week, you know what to do. Keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Save, pause, stop, stall.